Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to adjourn. Convene. Remember when they used to have tap-tap hearings? I'm going to convene the April 12, 2017 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources of the Ways and Means Committee. We're going to continue with the Water Resources Department this afternoon. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5542. If the department would come forward, please. Welcome back. Good afternoon to each of you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the director at the Oregon Water Resources Department. I want to I'll move us through the remaining elements of the presentation for our budget. We have chapters 4, 5, and 6. This is budget drivers, the governor's budget, and legislation, as well as reduction options, which we'll be stepping through for today. At the outset, though, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to just do a little bit of follow-up on a couple of questions that were raised yesterday. One, Co-Chair Frederick had asked for a map showing the high hazard dams. These are the dams that that the state has responsibility for from a dam safety standpoint of tracking, among other dams that we look at, that have, if they were to fail, that would affect human life. And so I believe you have in your materials a memo dated April 12th today to the co-chairs and the committee that has a map that shows all of the high hazard dams. It is organized by color coded, and you'll note, if you have access to that document, that there are six high hazard dams that are in unsatisfactory condition. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, Co-Chair Witt, members of the subcommittee. The answer was provided by the agency. It's a document that looks like this. And it's actually in the meeting materials for yesterday's meeting,
okay,
because that's when the question was asked if you're looking for it online.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just as a reminder, we have over 70 dams that are considered high hazard. Not all of them are in bad condition. In fact, very few of them are in bad condition. The worst condition is what we call unsatisfactory. And if you see the map, you'll see that there are six locations around the state where we have dams that are that are high hazard with unsatisfactory condition. And then you'll note with the color coding of the various levels of condition that we rate those dams at. These are all dams that we inspect on an annual basis. We work closely with the owners and operators of these dams to make the necessary adjustments, again, with a focus of protecting public safety. So I wanted to put that on your radar screen. I'd be happy to answer any questions relating to that. The other item that was raised, Senator Girard, you may remember when I was talking about the miners' claim to Shirttail Gulch at the beginning from 1878, and Senator Girard had asked, what's a miner's inch? And I didn't have a clue in terms of being able to respond to that, because that's not the how we measure water today. We did a little research on that, and this claim, as you may recall, was for 500 miner's inches in Shirttail Gulch, which, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, is a stream in between Baker City and Ontario, so you can get a sense of how dry it is out there. We believe that this amounted to about 500 square inches, which would have been maybe 22 by 22 inches, about the size of a sluice box for mining, and would amount to a rate of about 12.5 cubic feet per second, which is a fair amount of water, probably diverting maybe that whole stream at that time. It's not an active water right, in case you're wondering. We don't have a record of it today. But I would note that miners' inches was, in the 19th century, a way of measuring how much water was being used, but it really varied by state and probably even within the state. So it wasn't a uniform way to be able to measure water. That was a problem for obvious reasons, and we've moved to the cubic foot per second measurement since that time. So I just thought that was an interesting piece of history and wanted to follow up on that. So with that, I'm going to move into the budget drivers, and I'm going to try to move through this fairly quickly so that we can spend adequate time on the budget request from for the governor's budget for our agency. But as I talk about the budget drivers, just as a point of reorientation, we are a mission-driven agency. Our mission is to serve the public by practicing and promoting responsible water management, looking at both in-stream and out-of-stream needs. And when we do that, we are certainly do that with a lot of challenges and influences that affect our work on a day-to-day basis and the folks and the public who want to use water. By the way, this picture that you see here is the Owyhee Reservoir out south of Ontario, the Ontario area. This was during the, during the 2015 drought period where they had multiple dry years that had a severe impact on the reservoir levels. And today, due to one great year of cool weather and precipitation, it is, I think, full at this point. You may remember this is just the org chart for our agency, and I'm not going to step you through this other than just to point out one of the points I was trying to make yesterday and I want to reiterate today is that our agency really is, while we have while we're organized in different divisions, different sections, different programs, they really are, for us to be doing our job effectively, they are working together. And just as an example, around data being such an important part of what we do, while the expertise around data is in our technical services division, you might find that our field staff are the ones who are collecting it. And then that data then would get processed by our technical services division. Well, that data then informs our field activities in the distribution of water. It could inform water right-related decisions that we have. And, of course, it also could inform policy decisions in the director's office and with the commission or perhaps even with the legislature. So I'm just trying to make a point of how interconnected our activities are within the agency. Also want to reiterate how our mission is then further refined through several different mechanisms. One is the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. I mentioned this yesterday, and it does provide a more refined filter in terms of looking at our mission and applying it to applying more rigor and focus around it. The original Integrated Water Resources Strategy was adopted by our commission in 2012. We're now going through an updated process. We're required by statute to update it every 5 years. We held a series of town halls last year. We worked with a public advisory group for a number of months getting feedback on the update. The update's not an overhaul. It's more of a refinement. And we expect our commission to make that formal update for the 2017 version of the strategy by the end of this year. In your materials, you may see that there are over 40 recommended actions associated with the strategy, and that informs what we do. And you'll see as we get into our option packages how virtually all of those packages are connected to some of the recommendations within the strategy. But the other thing I wanted to point out is that the strategy itself is very, very high level, very broad document. We are going to be going through an exercise over the coming year with our commission, with stakeholders and staff in doing a strategic planning exercise that will take those recommendations from the strategy and put even more refinement and prioritization around those so that we have better clarity at the staff level in terms of what our priorities are and how we want to go about our business. And it will also inform our decisions around as we plan for the future as an agency. We'll also use this exercise as a mechanism to work on organizational improvements. I referred to some of those yesterday in terms of our efforts to look at workload in the field, and we'll also be looking at ways to better communicate both internally and externally. Another reminder from yesterday, we are steeped in history. This agency's been around a long time. The code has been around since 1909. and water uses predate the code. So there's a lot of actions that were taken many, many years ago that are still relevant to the decisions and actions that we take today around water use. We have no federal counterpart. The state is the entity, the governmental entity that is responsible for the allocation and distribution of water around the state. You'll note here on the picture on the bottom shows the code itself, an early stage from 1916. Then you see 1941, then the water code in 1980, and then 2015. And you'll note that it's grown over the years. That's not a criticism of anyone. It's just a reflection of the fact that as you build these programs and these systems for managing water, issues come up, needs arise, and those get addressed often in statute. And we have a very complicated system, quite frankly, and the statutes are just a piece of that. We also have a number of administrative rules that further refine and provide more guidance for those statutes, and then there's a host of case law associated with our activities that's also a factor. So it is a complicated area of law. I mentioned yesterday that one of the factors or one of the things that we do is around water availability, and that is to protect the existing users on systems, but also to make sure that if we're issuing new water rights to surface water holders, that there's a reasonably predictable water for them if they're going to pursue a water right. I just want to illustrate where we're at today. The map on the left shows what we our water availability for surface flows in August. And what I would like you to note is those areas that are kind of the purplish blue, aside from the river systems themselves, the shaded areas that are in purplish blue shade are areas where there is water available for new surface water rights in the month of August. The take home here is that there are very few places other than the main stem of the Willamette River and some of the Willamette and Cascade areas and far northeast Oregon where there's water available, frankly, during the times when most water users need it the most. So the easy water is gone. It's not available for most areas of the state. The map on the right shows our water availability during January. And you'll note that the shaded areas, the darker shaded areas, blue and purplish colors, are more extensive. That water is available not when people need it, of course, because that's when it's raining in most parts of the state, but it is available if folks want to do storage projects. So opportunities today are more around looking at capturing those winter flows and making those available then during the time of year when folks need it, which is not a simple task.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you mean, what exactly what do you mean that they're available for storage capacity? Because I thought that we didn't like people to store water without a permit.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Esquivel, thank you for that that point. What I mean is that it's available to apply for a permit. It doesn't mean that folks can go out and build a reservoir. There's a it is a long,
we've been there,
expensive
done that
process.
Down in Southern Oregon.
Yeah,
I ended up in jail for a while. But anyway,
folks still have to go through the permitting process.
I would like to see us encourage that with people when we have that availability, because that water is just going to go and be run off.
Thank you. I mentioned yesterday that as the easy availability for surface water has vanished in most parts of the state, a lot of folks, rather than trying to build storage because of the expense and complications of that, have gone to groundwater. The map on the left shows the those black dots is not mold. It actually shows where wells have been drilled. These are production wells that are permitted. There's about 25,000 permitted wells around the state. There's another well over 200,000 exempt wells for domestic and stock watering purposes that are not depicted here on that map. But it also shows you where the activity is. You can see in the Willamette Basin, down the Rogue Basin, the Klamath, northeast Oregon, along the Columbia Plateau, Harney Basin as well. On the right is a depiction of areas where based on color, where we show areas of concern around depletions of aquifer systems. The blue area are areas where we don't have current concern. Either there are areas where we're not seeing a lot of demand, or there are areas where we don't have as rich of data sets to be able to make distinctions. The green areas are areas where we're starting to see have some concern about the sustainability of the aquifer levels in those areas. And the orange areas are areas where we do see problems. The dots reflect different measurements that we're seeing in terms of declines or systems that are actually gaining. There are some systems that have gained, and those are represented by blue dots. But if you see a red dot, that's not good. That's showing that significant declines of aquifer systems. And you'll note there's a fair number of those in the Umatilla Basin. And those are areas where we have a number of administrative areas that have not only shut down the availability for new permits, but have actually forced us to curtail the uses of existing users in order to be able to try to reverse the trends there in terms of groundwater decline. Another driver for us is around drought. And drought's not it's not an abnormal occurrence. It happens especially for those who live in the Southern Oregon or Eastern Oregon. It's something that you live with on a fairly regular basis. The maps here I think are interesting because they tell a little bit of a story. And starting from the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see this is from the Drought Monitor, and this is a national science review that looks at precipitation conditions, soil moisture, a number of different factors in determining the conditions, dry conditions in the United States. And the bottom line is as the colors get darker and richer, you're having worse drought conditions. The red that you see there in the various maps are an indicator of extreme drought, not a situation that anyone wants to be in. In the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see the conditions in August of 2013. The top right, you'll see August 2014. You see that we're trending in a bad direction. In August, on the bottom left, you'll see August 2015. That was the extraordinary drought conditions that we had in the 2015 drought year, which included the coast area, which was pretty new for a lot of folks. And then in 2016, you'll see that we are starting to moderate. If I showed you a map today, the state would be white, which means we don't have any drought conditions across the state today, according to the Drought Monitor. Surprise. Things change over time.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Water Resources maintain data going back 20, 30, 40 years to see whether or not it goes in cycles with these drought cycles?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Lewis, we do maintain data both at surface water and with groundwater levels, but in this case it would be more of a surface water issue. Some of the stream gauging stations that we have data sets that go back 100 years, and those are very valuable to be able to understand trends and see what's happening over time. We work with universities and other entities that look at those long-term trends to try to make sure that they have functional data that can help us understand those things. It's still, there are folks who spend their careers working on these issues, and we work a lot with the U.S. Geological Survey, with NOAA and their climate folks, as well as Oregon State University on those issues. So our data does help very much on those.
Please.
So if you're able to go back, are you able to predict trends for future cycles, or does it go in cycles? I mean, do you see drought trends where, say, every 10 years, every 20, every 30 years, you go through these cycles?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Lewis, I think we can identify cycles as we look back in time. Predicting what's going to happen in the future is where it gets a lot more difficult. And I've got another slide here that does just that. But that is an emerging area of science.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for a complete year, correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Esquivel, this is for the month of August. So this is a point in time over the course of a
basis.
Year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They do monthly reports.
Okay, thank you.
So to Representative Lewis's question, this slide shows analysis by a number of scientists who were looking at climate change projections over the coming decades. And what this scenario looks at is really influenced by predicted temperature increases over time. On the top left, let me first orient you around the colors that you're looking at. And this is the Pacific Northwest. Obviously, you see Oregon, Washington, Idaho, parts of Canada. And in the green colors, you'll see rain-dominant systems. In the red colors, you'll see areas that have historically had a mix of rain and snow. And in the blue are snow-dominant systems, all right? So on the top left, you'll see what we've kind of considered to be our historical scenario around those different water regimes, and which is, from my vantage point, having grown up in eastern Oregon, those red colors in the Cascades and in eastern Oregon certainly make sense. On the right-hand column, from top to bottom, you have scenarios that go out to 2020, the 2040s, and the 2080s. And the point here is that under a temperature change scenario, we're going to see our systems change. And we'll move from a mixed rain and snow dominant areas in the Cascades and in eastern Oregon under this scenario by the 2080s to a very rain dominant system. And that's a big deal for folks that that have water rights, not just folks who are looking for water rights, new ones, but folks who have current water rights, especially those folks who have water rights that are dependent upon snowmelt and those spring flows that often are maybe accentuated by a couple spring rains, but are really benefit from the snowmelt that would occur that feeds the streams that they have their water rights on. So this is something that I'm no expert on this, but it's something we pay attention to, and we encourage communities who are trying to plan for their future to be mindful of this kind of information because it may influence some of the decisions they have as they plan for their water future. I mentioned at the outset and talked yesterday about this the challenge for us in terms of our carrying out our mission and looking at both in-stream and out-of-stream needs. And just wanted to talk a minute about, and I also mentioned about how the recognition of in-stream water rights and in-stream values was relatively late to the party in terms of our decisions that have been made around water use over time. So there's definitely a bit of a catch-up mode for conservation in-stream interests. Most of the senior rights are for out-of-stream purposes. That said, Oregon, I think, is very much a leader in the West in terms of having tools available to allow for transfers of existing out-of-stream rights to in-stream purposes. We also have the ability to for state agencies to apply for in-stream water rights. We do process in-stream water rights. We have the Department of Fish and Wildlife recently submitted 15 new in-stream water rights requests for small tributaries and the lower Willamette systems. We also routinely process proposals for allocations of conserved water and leases of in-stream leases as well as permanent transfers. These are really largely dependent upon third parties going out and working with willing landowners for those transactions. We do the processing in terms of the water rights related review, but we really rely on a lot of other folks. I want to just mention these two tables. I'm not going to go into the details on these, but the bars that you see show volumes of water that have been protected in stream over time. And the red line that moves through there just shows the number of projects that we've worked with over that same period of time. The last thing I would mention, we do work in partnership with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department around scenic waterways. These are not in-stream water rights, and they're not protected like a water right, but they do protect flows from the standpoint of looking at aesthetic values as well as recreation values of flows that are designated as scenic waterways, and that can have an impact on the development of new uses or restriction of new uses in order to protect those scenic waterways over time. Some other budget drivers. It's hard to go through a presentation about water without having a picture of marijuana leaves, and that is the new reality. And this is just another example of how things change over time. The the legalization of recreational use of marijuana has created a spike in growth in terms of development of marijuana and the growth of marijuana. We've received a lot of questions from folks in different parts of the state, folks who want to irrigate and are having questions about access to water, groundwater, or other sources. We also get questions from at the field level from neighbors and others who are interested or concerned about those new uses. The other thing I wanted to mention here is increased litigation. Our litigation costs have, in the last 3 years, have really skyrocketed. And as just to give you a sense of how that's played out, in the 2011-2013 biennium, we had 4 new litigation cases come on our plate. In the 3 years since that time, we've had 26 cases come forward. It's no coincidence, quite frankly, that in 2013 is the year that we began to start to regulate the use of water in the Klamath Basin in accordance with the progress that had been made with the adjudication. And much of the litigation that we're seeing in those 26 cases is coming out of that area where water users are asserting their ability to be able to question regulatory actions or the science underlying some of the regulatory actions that were taken in that area, or more broadly around the adjudication itself. I would point out that we do have a budget request to increase our funding around litigation costs. We are nearly $1 million over budget this biennium, and we've been covering that cost internally. I was hoping that it wouldn't be as large as it is, but we've had to extend a lot of vacancies for long periods of time, which of course then has impacts in terms of our availability to be able to cover other program areas.
Senator Girard.
The question I would have is, did the drought impact the litigation process as junior members had to shut off water?
Co-Chair Witt, Representative Girard, it's difficult to say. I would say we certainly did regulate further back in time and more senior uses than folks in many parts of the state were accustomed to. And we are seeing more cases come up where folks are litigating or they're litigating based on our actions to regulate them according to the priority system, which is of concern, quite frankly, to us, because there's in our statutes we have a kind of a unique provision that stays the enforcement until the judicial review occurs. Well, if you do that during an enforcement season, we aren't able to enforce the junior water right holder during that time period, which I think, which I assume would be of concern to those senior users over time. We'll be tracking that issue because that is one that at some point there may be a need to visit that from a policy perspective. So thank you for that question. Okay, I am going to briefly talk about some of our meeting future needs, and I've talked about this, and I'll talk about this more in some of our option packages that I'll get to in a minute. Many folks consider the core functions of this agency around issuing water right related decisions and regulating in the field, you know, according to priority. We're very excited that the legislature has moved us and allowed us to kind of a new area that makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it does to a lot of the folks that we work with, that allows us to help communities plan for their future water needs. And this is the Water Resources Development Program. It's a primarily a grant and loan program that allows for collaborative community-based planning. It allows for technical grants that help communities figure out their needs, and also allows funding for projects. I'll talk about this more when we get into our option packages. We also have a couple of other funding mechanisms. The Water Supply Fund, which is a vehicle that allows the legislature to appropriate funds for specific purposes. We have three areas right now where those funds have been useful. One is to help support grants for place-based planning. Another is funding in the Umatilla Basin, which has allowed us to incent work to develop water out of the Columbia River, and to work with folks who are seeking to develop water out of the Columbia River that's fully mitigated. And the third is around area in Mosier where there are well construction problems problems within those aquifer systems that is affecting the users of that system. And we're looking to use those funds to help remediate those issues. I'm going to skip through this pretty quickly, but around the planning that I mentioned, we have through the 2015 legislative appropriation $750,000 that we've split between four areas that we're working with in the state around this collaborative planning process. The whole idea around this is to get communities to work together, to bring the various interests that are represented in that community together to talk about the resources that they have, what they see as their future needs, and to develop ideas on projects that can help meet those needs. And it can range from in-stream ecological value to out-of-stream needs. But the key point here is to get folks working together and to build that social and political, local political momentum around that. We have a couple staff tied to this who are helping to work in side by side with these communities. This is it's an exciting area for me, and I think I am very hopeful that it will bear fruit for these communities over time. We'll be reporting back to you by the 2019 legislative session on the progress of these groups. I mentioned the feasibility grants. These are technical grants. This program's been around for nearly 10 years, I believe. We had $2.7 million available this biennium. We expect that we've already awarded $1.7 million in grants. We have another grant cycle that our commission will be making decisions on in May. We expect that another $500,000 essentially will be awarded at that time. We're seeking to carry forward the remainder of those funds to be available for future grant cycles next biennium for feasibility grants. Another new program for us is our project funding. This is the Water Supply Development Account, Senate Bill 839 from 2013. The authorization occurred in 2013. During that biennium, there were a number of work groups and a task force that worked, as well as a rulemaking process that created that basically enabled us to be able to move forward. In a combination of 2013 funding, lottery bond funding, as well as 2015 funding, we had $14 million available with the startup of this program. Our first grant cycle, which occurred in 2016, had $50 million worth of requests for the state funds. We had $14 million available. We decided to expend or to award 8.9 roughly of that $14 million. The primary reason for that is that the bulk of our lottery bond funding was not the bond wasn't sold until just last week, and so we wanted to be careful about not issuing a bunch of grants that we wouldn't be able to make payments on for another year. That, you know, in having this program get a few years under our belts with grant funding will give us more fluidity in terms of being able to make sure that we can make payments in a timely manner. We now have a 2017 offering for this grant program. It just closed last week, I believe, and we had about 33 applications for around $37 million. So it's another robust request. We're excited about that. The grant cycle will, the awards by the commission will take place in November of next year. And what's notable on this is that they weren't all grant requests. We received three loan requests as well. So that'll be our first test drive of our loan program under this new program. The loans, I think, were for about $3.5 million, roughly.
Senator Jarrett.
Yeah, do we have any, thanks, Chair Witt. Do we have any major water storage projects in the works? Water is going to be the new gold coming down. I mean, you pointed that out very graphically, and we're going to need more water storage. Has anybody started thinking ahead for major water storage for both drinking and irrigation?
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Jarrett, thank you for that question. The answer is yes. I mean, people are working at it, and quite frankly, these legislative investments that I'm talking about right now are helping to feed that mm-hmm. that interest. These don't come out of thin air. It takes time and takes investment. But there is work underway. Different communities are at different stages of development. But we're seeing requests come in for our projects that include storage projects, some of them relatively modest. Some are just to expand existing facilities. But we consider it all to be good, whether it's looking at storage or looking at efficiencies to systems, because some of the delivery systems we've seen in Central Oregon in particular, where they've moved from canals to piping, has created great benefits, multiple benefits, both ecologically as well as for the water user. So we are kind of all of the above right now in terms of working with communities to get them thinking about those options.
Thank you, Chairman. The further question would be, are you working with the feds? And when I say big water projects, I mean like Detroit Dam sort of projects. The ones that really probably wouldn't be popular right now. However, down the road, it's going to be a lifesaver for a bunch of these communities, because we're simply not going to have enough drinking water.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Jarrett, we certainly work with the federal government and the Bureau of Reclamation in particular and the Army Corps of Engineers around storage issues. And, in terms of expanding storage at the federal level, it hasn't been really an option in recent years, although with the new administration, infrastructure is talked about a lot. I think we'll just have to wait and see whether water infrastructure is an area of interest and whether they provide guidance to the federal agencies to pursue it and their funding to be able to make that happen. If that's the case, we would certainly want to be involved in those conversations and work with the communities in those areas. We work with the Bureau in different areas of the state, including the Willamette Basin, where we work primarily with the Corps of Engineers. There's a lot of water stored behind the 13 federal reservoirs in the Willamette Basin, and we're in the midst of discussions now, and our agency is in the lead on that at the state level in terms of looking at how that 1.6 million acre feet of storage could be allocated among different uses. Currently, it's just allocated for agricultural purposes. We know that there are a number of municipalities who are interested in accessing that storage, as well as potentially conservation and recreation needs.
One further question. You brought up an interesting point, because the Corps, especially up where I live, manages the dams predicated on flood risk and not for economic value. Have you been involved in any of those discussions? Because that means that they draw the water down prior to what they probably should, and it just seems to me like we could manage that water a lot better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jarrett, we certainly are in regular communication with the Corps. Their federal authorization is around flood control, and that is their primary purpose. And that'll take an act of Congress to change that. But there is a lot of storage behind those reservoirs, and kind of the secondary use behind the flood control purposes does create a lot of opportunity for folks in the Willamette Basin in terms of using that stored water. So there are some options, even with the Corps continuing to manage the system as is.
No, I'm good.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair Witt.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chair, I'm gonna start speeding up here a little bit, if you will, so I can make sure I get to the governor's budget and give us some time for that. With this slide, what I want to emphasize is that we spend a lot of time working with communities at the basin level, and these are can often be very complex negotiations or discussions, trying to figure out how to resolve or meet the needs of the community, ranging from the Umatilla Basin, where we're working with conservation groups and irrigators on project development that would be mitigated in the Columbia River. Also in the Umatilla Basin, we're working with the Umatilla tribes and others around potential settlement of tribal interests for water. In the Deschutes Basin, there are a range of issues associated with future planning. There are a number of different Endangered Species Act species issues that are make water management challenging. The Klamath Basin is the adjudication and the settlement discussions that have been ongoing for a number of years. And in the Willamette Basin, which I just talked about, where we've been working with the Corps of Engineers and many stakeholders representing ag, municipal, and other interests around looking at how that stored water behind those reservoirs might be allocated in the future. And groundwater is another area where we're spending more and more time not just managing water rights, not just issuing decisions around water right transactions, but working with the community, especially in those areas where we're seeing groundwater declines. The Walla Walla Sub-Basin is an area where we're spending more and more time working with the community around groundwater concerns. The Greater Harney Valley, the Harney Basin, where the legislature provided funding in 2016 to help us move forward with the groundwater study. And I mentioned earlier the Mosier area, where well construction problems have created issues with groundwater there. Very briefly, I just want to let you know that we are very proud of the work that we do with our staff and are constantly looking at how we can improve our services. Just want to point out a few areas that have been ongoing this biennium. One is we've been working on upgrading our groundwater database just to have a more centralized area for groundwater-related information. That will create some efficiencies for us as a staff. And we'll have greater and easier access for the general public over time as well in terms of groundwater information. We've moved into the 20th century in terms of establishing credit card payments for some of our fees. We are updating some of our water rights related processes so that to avoid unnecessary duplication of data input, which is an incredible time saver. And we also have been working with a number of state agencies around shared services around payroll. I'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into our option packages. Looking to the future, strategic planning that I've mentioned, we'll be working on work plans associated with groundwater as well as other areas of our agency. As we discussed yesterday, we will be conducting a review of our key performance measures and reporting back to you on potential modifications to those. We'll be assessing our workload of our field staff and evaluating the water use measurement program that we have. So that was a whirlwind on chapter four, and I now want to move us into our budget discussion for the governor's budget. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. You have this information, but my main point here is that under the governor's budget, as I think is you've probably seen with a number of other agencies, the agency's budget is proposed to have both cuts and additions. For our agency, this would have a net gain under the governor's budget proposal, but I'll step you through the pieces of this as we go into the option packages. Package 102 would allow us to shift a limited duration position that helps us with dam safety inspections to permanent status. It does not involve general fund. It's a split of other funds, fee revenue, as well as federal funds that we receive from the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA. This is an important position, as you can see at the bottom, and you'll see this, and I won't be able to speak to the specific actions. I don't have those burned into my memory banks, but just wanted to let you know that these option packages that you'll see are tied to actions that are identified in the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. This is an important position and will allow us to be able to maintain our current service level in terms of being able to inspect dams, and especially those high hazard dams that we want to get out and look at on an annual basis. This is our second package that has a public safety related element, and it involves has two elements associated with it, but both have to do with well construction. And again, with well construction, the key here is that we want to make sure that wells are properly constructed. If they aren't, it can have dramatic impacts, negative impacts on aquifer systems. And there are two components to this bill or to this package. One is that we're seeking to reclass six existing well inspector positions. And what we want to be able to do here is, rather than add more staff, we want to expand the capabilities of those staff. These are folks who are out in the field working with well drillers and landowners who are drilling wells. And these are increasingly technically complex reviews. To the extent that we can have those well inspectors cover more territory for us while they're out there in the field and not have to go back and talk to our groundwater hydrogeologists, we provide better service for the folks that we work for, and we're more efficient in how we do our work out in the field. That's the $40,000 other fund. These are fee-based revenues that we'd be looking at for that reclass. The other piece of this, you see in the towards the middle where it says fee revenue of $88,000. This is tied to a bill. This is House Bill 2296. And the fee revenue actually has been reduced because the bill has been amended. So the fee revenue that we would be looking at this point would be $38,000 of other funds. And this is associated with a, and we'll talk more about this when this, if this bill gets a hearing, but it's associated with increasing the fee associated with landowners who seek to drill their own well rather than having it hired out. The fee that is current is $25, and what we're trying to do is capture more of our costs associated with the work that we do with these landowners. They typically don't know what they're doing, no disrespect, and it takes a lot of staff time from the very beginning to the very end to make sure that those wells that the landowners drill are done appropriately. So we're looking to increase that from $25 to $500. That's the low end of what we estimate our cost would be in terms of time. Our time ranges, our estimates are from $500 to about $3,000 of staff time associated with working with these folks. So package 104, now we're shifting from kind of public safety to helping to meet current and future water needs. And I mentioned the place-based planning, this collaborative community-based planning effort. We have four pilot projects funded with grant dollars that we're working on. We have two positions who are dedicated to working with those communities. One of those positions was limited duration, and we're seeking to continue that position so that we can continue to provide the support to those groups over the next 2 years. It is general fund that we would that we'd be seeking on that. We are creating some savings in this proposal by eliminating 0.75 FTE for a position that we had that managed our feasibility grants, and blend that in with this position. This position will be taking on additional responsibilities. We think that we can manage okay on the place-based planning piece, but I would point out that if we go down this path, it probably means that we don't have as many grant cycles around for our feasibility grants over the future biennia under this scenario, just because of the workload concerns. Package 109. This is lottery bond dollars, $2 million that we're seeking with some additional funds for the cost of issuance of the lottery bond. These are for feasibility grants. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be granting probably a little over $2 million this biennium for feasibility grants. This would keep us on par with that going into this next biennium. These are important grants because they help with the technical analyses that help test the viability of potential proposed projects for communities who are seeking future water supply projects. Package number 110 is another lottery bond package. This one involves $30 million that we're seeking here, and these are for projects. This is for any entity or individual who's seeking to increase their water supply through a groundwater recharge project, perhaps, or a surface water storage project, or efficiency projects, piping efficiencies, for example. These dollars can be moved or can be used to help support those efforts. We look at both economic, environmental, and community benefits when we consider these projects. This also has cost of issuance and debt service associated with it. These are, again, important projects to help communities really start to get the horsepower and momentum to act to develop and act on meeting their future water needs. Package 100, this is connected to House Bill 2295, which you'll hear more about at a later date. But this is an important, this is a fee bill for us, and these fees support our water rights related work that I talked about yesterday, transfers, water right permitting. There's a whole range of activities that we have related to water users' needs in this program area. That program area has been historically funded in a combination of general fund and fee revenue. And the target has been to try to get about 50-50 split between those two revenue sources. We are seeking an increase of fee revenue in order to be able to maintain our current services. So when you see that 2.5 FTE on the screen here, we're not asking for new positions. This would avoid us from losing, this would help us to avoid losing positions, which would occur if we didn't have the fee increase. We're looking at across the board fees. There are many fees associated with this. They're all in statute. And we're looking at about a 15.88% increase in order to be able to keep up with costs over a four-year period. Package 101. This is a general fund request. We're looking at, I believe, five positions here, 4.4 FTE. It's assumed for a 21-month period. And of the $1.8 million associated with this, about half those funds would support staff. The other half, as you see in the second bullet here, would support a number of technical needs as well as monitoring needs, measurement needs. This is would give us the ability to be able to really expand our bandwidth for studying groundwater around the state. Currently, under our current resources, we can do one groundwater study, one basin study in any given biennium. This would allow us to add one more into the mix. And there are a number of areas where we'd like to do that, including the Walla Walla sub-basin that I mentioned earlier. There are other areas along the Columbia Basin that would also would deserve that kind of further study. These studies help communities and groundwater users in those communities better understand the resource and help us better make better management decisions over time. This would also, I think, have some collateral benefits for us by expanding our staff in the technical services division and may help us be able to pay more routine attention to permitting related reviews as well by adding these additional staff. Package 105 would increase our field presence, and here we're looking at a number of different ways to do that. It would add three regional assistant water masters. Those would be housed in I think the Willamette Basin, the Southwest, and East, if I recall. And those folks, they have similar responsibilities to the water masters that I've mentioned. But in this case, they would serve at the region level, and so they would be able to address emerging issues or hot spots, if you will, within a broader area than the water master, than a water master would serve within their district. It also requests a hydrotech position. These are our field staff who do measurements that help inform the science, groundwater science, and surface water science in our technical services division. We are also seeking a reclass of five hydrotechs. Again, similar to the well inspectors, we want to be able to expand the capacity of what they can do, and this will allow us to do more with the same positions. That's a $32,000 ask associated with that. The next item reminds me that I forgot to mention the Drought Task Force in an earlier item, and I apologize for doing that. That was an important effort that we had related to drought. Representative Helm was a key in that. This was a legislative task force. Representative Helm and Senator Roebland chaired the group, and they worked at breakneck pace to develop a number of recommendations on potential areas where we could improve as a state around preparing for and dealing with drought emergencies. One of the areas was a recognition that the department, not having any kind of communications staff, that having a position that could do field conservation, coordinating work, and outreach with communities would be very valuable for us. And quite frankly, I see that as a valuable resource for us, whether we're dealing with drought or not. There's a lot of opportunity for us to, as an agency, to be more proactive in reaching out to communities to educate them on opportunities to conserve water, and just to keep them better informed around such a precious resource. The last element to this package has to do with litigation costs, where we're seeking an increase to meet some of those needs that I identified earlier. Payroll shared services. This is a request for $67,000 of other funds. These would be funds that we would accept from the Department of State Lands around a shared services model that we've had working with a number of agencies for some time, and I'm very proud and excited about it. Essentially, what we're doing is we have two payroll staff who are housed under our roof who are working not just for our agency in terms of payroll-related work and benefit-related work, but are working with five agencies and providing those services to five agencies. They are the Water Resources Department, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, the Department of State Lands, the Land Use Board of Appeals, and Housing. We're all in close proximity in the North Mall area, just down the way. And those two staff are serving 450 FTE. You know, we're an agency that has about 163 or so FTE. So you can see the benefits of that shared services model, and it's working quite well for us. And we've been working on creating kind of similar templates for all the agencies, so that those two staff can easily go from one agency to the next and provide strong services. So that's been a great area for us, and we're excited to report out on that and hope that we can receive this limitation to be able to continue it into next biennium. This package 107 has to do with conversations that I've been having, that we've been having at the department with Umatilla County. The county, we've had a long history of working with counties around the state, and there's a history of county investment in field staff, in local water masters. And it varies across the state. We have a number of counties that provide resources on an annual basis. They provide office space for our staff at the local level. We have other counties that don't, and it's completely really dependent upon the county's level of interest. Umatilla County has provided significant resources over the years, and we've been very grateful for their commitment over time. It is a highly managed system in the Umatilla Basin, and that additional staff and funding support has been very helpful. The county is certainly looking at their budget issues, as the state is, and has signaled that they are uncertain about their ability to be able to fund positions in the future. They've also signaled that, so that's been one issue. The other issue is that these positions, there are five positions that historically have been county positions that have been managed and supervised by our regional office in Pendleton. And the county has asked us to, they no longer want to have those positions on, essentially under their HR services, and they want to formally move those over to the state as state positions. What this is asking is for the ability to move those county positions into state positions. It is assuming that the county funding will continue. It is assuming that part of those positions are also funded. Two of those five positions are also funded with federal dollars, but were county positions. So we're simply moving those county positions over to state positions. We're not asking to backfill those positions with state funding at this stage. That hasn't been part of the discussion. So this package would assume that those funds at the federal level and the county level would continue.
Chair Witt.
Senator Gerard.
I thought you were, aren't you at a place where you're going to, I'll keep going for a little bit.
Yeah, we're getting to the end here. I won't belabor this. These are the two bills that I've mentioned in some of the conversation today. We hope to talk to you further about those at a future hearing. They're important to us. Now we'll get into the long-term vacancies.
Okay. The question I had is, and it's probably more of a statement than anything else, you're asking $32 million from lottery with POPs 110 and 109. We only have, just so you know, $226 million, of which we're, the ask may go up to $500 million. So what I'm telling you is LFO may very well try to pare you down in those arenas.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Gerard, understood. So I want to start off just by saying this is one of our staff persons doing a field measurement at Cultus Creek in the Deschutes Basin near Lapine. And behind him, you'll see a stream gauge building. But I can't tell you how thrilled we are to see the levels of snow that we have this year. I've got pictures from 2 years ago where we show a water master up on a mountaintop in the wintertime, and there's no snow up there. And he's actually holding, I think he's holding his hand up to show where the average snow levels would be, and there was nothing. So things change over time. That's not a harpoon in his hand. That is a field measurement device, believe it or not. Package 070, this is, I mentioned the water right fee bill and the option package that would allow us to maintain our water right services related functions over the next 4 years. Again, this 50-50 split between fee revenue and general fund, this will allow us to be able to keep our current staff at cost. If we don't, if that bill is not passed and those fees are not increased, we will revert back to 2009 fee levels, which means we will have to reduce our staff by 2.5 FTE. So this package reflects that potential reality. This, I apologize, there's a lot on this slide, but this reflects the governor's budget at, I think, 7% budget reduction. And just to step you through some of the general fund reductions that we'd be looking at, it's a total of $2.3 million under this scenario, and would eliminate a general fund of $805,000 that currently in our base budget for feasibility study grants. As you may recall, I mentioned earlier that we're seeking lottery bond dollars to replace that. It would reduce our cost share measurement fund from $107,000 to $57,000. This is cost share that helps water right holders to install measurement devices so we can track their uses over time. It would reduce general fund money for installing new observation wells to track groundwater levels over time. and it would also reduce groundwater study funds. We're hoping that we can work with you to reverse that latter piece, the $188,000. We're really concerned about that being in there because it would hinder our ability to follow through on the commitments we've made to the folks in the Harney Basin around the groundwater studies that that were initiated through funding in 2016. We also have fund reductions for gauging stations, and of course, concerned about the next item, which would be four general fund administrative positions. These would be two field administrative positions, as well as one that would affect the director's office and the technical services division. These are important positions. They provide a lot of support for our staff and customer service in terms of answering the phone, setting up meetings, providing a lot of support that without these positions, our technical staff and policy staff and field staff will have to spend more time on those functions. The second to last bullet would be a fund shift where we'd be moving $392,000 to the general fund for a couple of positions that support Oregon Plan related work around the state. Shift those over to Measure 76 operating lottery funds. And then lastly, we would be looking at a $27,000 reduction for general fund services and supplies. These last two items are reductions that we would take due to reductions that would occur in other agencies. I won't belabor those. And that is the end of our presentation.
Very good. Any questions or comments at this point? Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You seem to have some people out there doing studies here, studies there, whatever. Could you get us a list of how many people you have doing studies and what they're working on and what the outcomes are?
Mr. Co-Chair.
There's got to be an end someplace.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Esquivel, we think
maybe
that,
not with water, though. I thought about that.
We think that data is really important as a foundation of decisions that we make. It's important to the communities that we work with. They want to know what's going on, and as the resource becomes more limited and more competition over it, we think that that data is going to be extremely important. We can certainly pull some information together to give you a sense of the, for example, the groundwater study that we're working on in the Harney Basin. There are some other areas where we work with our partners on development of data. So we'll pull together a list for the committee for that.
That follow-up? Go ahead. The groundwater in the Harney County area is very interesting to me because when I was 8 years old or 10 years old, I spent a summer on the Moon Ranch by the Moon Reservoir. And there used to be artesian wells there. I don't know if there still is artesian wells. They're coming right out of the ground in the desert.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Esquivel, it is an interesting basin geologically. When we started to work with them on their groundwater issues, because we've been seeing declines over years and we're concerned about existing users there, I got an earful from folks, and they were being sincere when they said, that they will have flood waters in the spring and then drought by the time August rolls around. So it's a very interesting system. It's pretty unique for us to work with. We've certainly are very encouraged by the partnership that we've had with the community there and very optimistic that we'll be able to come up with some good long-term solutions for them.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right, then, Ms. Connolly?
No, we don't have to.
Here? All right.
Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Kathy Connolly with DAS Chief Financial Office, and I'm here to give you a brief overview of the agency's governor's budget for the Water Resources Department. The agencies discussed with you their emerging issues, their continuing issues around groundwater management, staffing levels, and water supply, the growing water supply needs in this state that don't look like they're going to be reduced anytime in the future. For this slide, this is the normal expenditure history slide that I always show you. And I just want to take this opportunity to make 2 points. Number one, this agency is overwhelmingly, for its operations, a general fund agency. It has these large other funds, but those are bonds. And that's why you see these sharp drops from year to year. In 13-15, the agency had authority to issue bonds of over $10 million, but they did not issue them. In 15-17, the agency had authority to issue $51 million of bonds. They will have issued 20, or DAS will have issued $21 million. But next biennium, when you see this, you're going to see that another sharp drop in their actuals, because $30 million of their bonding didn't get issued. So I just want to emphasize that general fund is very important to this agency's operations, even though they have a lot of other fund in their budgets. That's bonding. It's going out the door for projects, by and large. This is another way. This shows the same story. This is what they spend it on. There's only 41% of their budget is spent on personal services and supplies and services. The rest is debt service and special payments going out the door. These special payments are particularly large because some of them are both carry forward from prior biennia and new investments. So feasibility studies have both carry forward and new investment in 17-19. Place-based planning is all carry forward. The Umatilla and Mosier Creek is all carry forward. The water supply development account is both new carry forward from the 15-17 biennia, because we just sold those bonds, so they're just beginning to send them out the door. So a lot of that money is going to get carried over, but it's also a new investment in the 17-19. Revenue history is showing you, you know, you see this even more as time goes on. But the blue bar here is what really runs this agency. It's the general fund. They do have some power and water fees revenue and charges for services, but that totals, in the current biennium, about $10.3 million. In the governor's budget, it's about $11.1 in revenues, in fee revenue, what we think of as fee and contract for services revenue. And a chunk of that goes out the door to DEQ and ODFW, about $2.4 million, $2.5 million. So they do have other funds to operate some of their programs, but that that is what is driving the increased ask for fees, because it's a way to have more support from the users of the agency. Agency's done a great job of talking to you about their investments. I did want to note that for things like the revenue for shared services, that is a revenue package. And for the Umatilla field presence, that is only limitation. If the funding doesn't come through, the agency doesn't hire. So it isn't like the state's going to be on the hook for that, the general fund. Agencies also talk to you about their reductions, and the governor does support the fee changes the agency has asked for and supports the amended bill in it also. So with that, unless there are further questions, last call. This is my last presentation.
Subcommittee members?
I have one quick question.
Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. The question is, in a lot of these committees, we've seen reclassifications, and quite a few of them. And, those are pretty substantial. In this one, it was almost a $7,000 pay raise. Per employee. Why are we seeing so many of those? And it just seems like these budgets have had quite a few of them. I'm just kind of curious as to the reason of the governor when we were in such a tight budget year.
Co-Chair Witt, Senator Gerard, in this particular agency, what's driving it a lot is simply competition. Well, it's two things. It's number one, management of water is becoming much more complex. Dam safety is becoming more complex. Well drilling is becoming more complex. And so the type of person who is needed for the position, the skills are going up. In addition, we're competing with the the private sector for these people. I mean, the people who are at Water Resources, they can go and earn more money in the private sector. And so this agency, and the director may want to address this in more detail, but they have had difficulty. They've either retaining their staff or recruiting their staff. And so that's what these reclassifications in this agency are trying to address. Director, did you?
Well said.
Anyone else? Matt, you okay? Well, I'm not seeing or hearing anything else. Thank you both very, very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5542. And Kathy, thank you for spending so much time with our committee. Is there anything else to come here today? Any announcements, Senator Girard?
Yes. Are we going to have any more open hearings for input for the Department of Forestry budget? The reason I ask that question is the people paying the bills really didn't get much chance to testify, and I think that that would be a good thing.
Yes. Short answer is yes, and we don't have a date specific, but near term, relatively near term.
Okay.
So, yeah. Anyone else? Folks can plan on public comments on this budget tomorrow. And with that, if there's nothing else, we stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone.